Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Mark My Words here on the Life Coach Radio Network, and today is December 15th, 2013. I'm Mark Shaw, broadcasting live from New York City. I'm a certified life and business coach, and twice per month I host Mark My Words, which is a life coaching-oriented show where I interview various people who have inspiring life stories of overcoming adversity. I also speak with authors of great coaching-related books and programs, as well as many others who have great things to say. So be sure to tune in to us the first and third Sunday of every month. I hope everybody's enjoying the beginning of the craziness of the holiday season. And speaking of the holiday season, I just ran in the door and got back from a wonderful concert performance this afternoon at Manhattan's Town Hall on 43rd Street. And it was the annual holiday show of the New York City Gay Men's Chorus, of which I've been a singing member myself, this fine group of men, for about 18 years now. I had to sit out this concert due to my travel schedule with my coaching business, and I have to say that being in the audience is a nice change once in a while. To see how we look and hear how we sound, I have to say I was quite impressed. And what struck me as I was watching was, as I thought of my history in the chorus, was how much there is to being in the chorus that's beyond the music. And the most stunning, is the word I would use, piece of that, is the tremendous taking care of each other that occurs. I happen to be the chairman of what's known in the chorus as the Nightingale Brigade. The Nightingale Brigade helps take care of people when they're sick and in the hospital, or if they're at home after a hospitalization, whether it's, you know, foot surgery or something cancer-related or anything else, and they need some practical support, the Nightingale Brigade kicks in, and we make sure that person has the support they need, whether that's travel and transit to and from doctor's appointments, food shopping that needs to be done, or just friendship and emotional support. We make sure that if someone's in the hospital, they're getting cards and visitors. And we even had a member who needed a kidney transplant 2 years ago. And yes, one of our members actually ended up donating his kidney. And when I think about that kind of support and that kind of caregiving that we do for one another in the chorus, I'm amazed. And I realize that the true purpose of being in the chorus is not the music. That's just the byproduct of the wonderful community that we create. We have a member right now, Tom, who is in hospice care with cancer. And he has the support and love of his chorus family around him at this incredible time of need in his life. And it provides so much comfort to him because he's been in the chorus for many, many years. So caregiving is a large part of the community and family function of the chorus, which brings me to tonight's topic. And I'd like to dedicate tonight's show to my dear friend Tom. Thank you, Tom, for all you give to the New York City Gay Men's Chorus and for helping to make it the kind of community it is. I want you to know that we love you and that tonight's show on caregiving is my holiday gift from me to you. So caregiving, that's tonight's topic. And I'm going to be interviewing certified professional coach and author Michael Bloom. And Michael Bloom has written an incredible book called The Accidental Caregiver's Survival Guide, Your Roadmap to Caregiving Without Regret. And he's helped to revitalize the careers and hundreds of family and professional caregivers with practical, tactical, soul-saving coping strategies. And he supports them in saving lives, including their own. With a wealth of practical expertise as both a family and professional caregiver, Michael serves as a welcome and sought-after catalyst to guide caregivers and health and human service leaders to stay energized and committed to work that has never been more important or vital than it is today. Having earned 2 master's degrees in psychology and social policy, Michael's passion for lifelong learning is best expressed through the practical sharing of game-changing tips that make urgent and real impact when and where they're needed most. So tonight, Michael's going to be talking about his experiences his coaching and give us some practical tips as well. And he'll also be talking with us about his book, The Accidental Caregiver Survival Guide, Your Roadmap to Caregiving Without Regret. So welcome to the show, Michael.
Mark, it is such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here. It's as you know, this is a topic that's a bit near and dear to my heart as well, as my mom is currently the primary caregiver for my dad, who is in a nursing home with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's dementia. So I'm well aware of the issues that come up around caregiving as I see my mom on her journey through it. And some of the practical advice in your book has been incredibly valuable to me in helping my mom get some of that to make a difference in her life. So I am indebted to you, and I thank you. And it's just absolutely a delight and an honor to have you on the show.
Oh, again, it's such a great pleasure. And I just want to add, I'm so glad that you're dedicating this show to your dear friend Tom, and what a wonderful story you shared about the Nightingale Brigade. And if we just maybe, I'll even add to extend the honor to you and all the other caregivers that are part of the Gay Men's Chorus that are serving in that brigade as valued members of the caring force. You know, there are currently 65 million people in the United States that are serving in some sort of caregiving role for a friend or a family member in
wow.
an unpaid capacity. So your Nightingale Brigade is such an important aspect, especially to those that may not have other family members close by that can care for them when they're in their time of need. So
mm-hmm.
I extend the dedication and honor. I'm taking the privilege to do that to all of you as well as Tom. So you all shine in this show together.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. I really I appreciate that. And many of them are listening now as well. Actually, they're not listening live because they're on stage with their evening performance as we speak, but they'll be listening to the archive, as all our listeners are able to do. So thank you. I appreciate that very much, Michael. And also, by the way, for our listeners, we will be taking your calls, as usual, if you have comments or questions for Michael or for myself. And so in the latter half of the show, we'll be taking those questions, and the number to call in for those is 646-716-9397, 646-716-9397, to call in with your questions and comments. Let's see, sometimes people post them on Facebook for me as well, if I have the chance to look at that during the show. And there's also our chat room on the blogtalkradio.com website on the show page, and you can submit questions that way as well. So now that we have all the housekeeping out of the way, Michael, tell us a little bit about your background. What got, I mean, out of all the different niches, or niches, as I must say when I teach in Canada, that you could have chosen as a coach, why caregiving? Tell us a little bit about how that came about for you.
Well, I think caregiving is in my blood. I have pretty much done it my entire career. Once I graduated from college, I started working in a direct care capacity supporting individuals with developmental disabilities. My first professional job actually was working in a group home supporting six adults with autism. And I've had more than 20 years experience working within the developmental disability community, and it's been such an honor and a privilege to do that, and I've learned so much. But 4 years ago, a little over probably about 4.5 years ago, caregiving came really close at home in terms of my family. My dad had been, who was 82 at the time, had been serving as the primary caregiver for my mom. So kind of similar to your situation, Mark, where your mother and you together have provided some care and support to your dad. In this case, my mom had been the ill parent. She was a cancer survivor. She did have a mind. She didn't have dementia. But she was very frail and weak, and for 5 years needed a lot of physical support from my father, taking care of everything in the household. So one morning in the summer of 2009, I got a frantic call from my mother saying that my dad was acting very strangely. He wouldn't get their breakfast or their morning medication, and she didn't understand what was going on. He seemed confused, so I ran over. I lived about 5 miles apart in my own house and drove over, and when I got there, I found him kind of slumped over in his chair in his home office. So I immediately called 911. I thought he had a stroke, but when the EMTs came out, they assessed him. They found that he had a heart rate of 25. they got him rushed to the hospital. They stabilized him. He was having a catastrophic heart failure event. They put a pacemaker in. But the event probably took place while he was sleeping the night before is when it started. So he had a lot of oxygen deprivation to the brain, ended up with vascular dementia, and my dad would never regain his mind. So at the snap of the fingers, from the night before to that day, he would forever need, from that point forward, need 24/7 support himself. So he could no longer be my mom's caregiver. He needed even more intense care than she did. So I stepped in to care for them both. I'm an only child. It was a no-brainer for me. You know, I had all this, you know, professional caregiving background and stepped in. So I put my career aside. I ended up moving in with them. I eventually put my house on the market. And over the next years, I served as the primary full-time live-in caregiver for them both. And the reason, you know, I eventually wrote my book, The Accidental Caregiver Survival Guide, is most family caregivers end up entering the caregiving role, not from pre-planning or, you know, from, you know, just sort of like a set pathway. A medical crisis happens with a loved one or an injury, you know, a car accident or, you know, a veteran returning from war. I also want to give a great shout out to the family caregivers that are supporting veterans right now. I just read a recent statistic that there are 1 million caregivers in the United States caring for a loved one who has returned from war with injury from Iraq and Afghanistan over the past years. So of that 65 million, 1 million are them. So again, people are, you know, entering this role. And when you enter the role, all the services and all the supports are really dedicated to the patient or loved one that has the medical crisis. And the caregiver kind of ends up in this role floundering, focused selflessly on their loved one without a lot of support to themselves. So it's so easy to lose yourself in the process, which is why I wanted to develop a pathway for caregivers to get a real, you know, practical strategies and support so they can be dedicated, provide high-quality care for the loved one in a sustainable way, but live their own life in the process, so and not sacrifice themselves completely, which is very easy to do.
Sure, sure. In fact, my understanding, Michael, is that many caregivers, when they're in the caregiver role, many caregivers die before the person they're giving care for simply because of stress-related illnesses. What's your thought on that?
And that's very true. And, you know, one of the strategies I tend to share with caregivers is that because, and I hear this a lot, and I actually was just giving a talk a few weeks ago to a group of people supporting loved ones with Parkinson's disease. So like you mentioned, your dad has Parkinson's. And and people who end up with Parkinson's, most of them later stages end up with dementia. So in this case, it was a dad or a father or a husband that had Parkinson's, and the wife, because she was doing a lot of physical care, her shoulders were, she had two torn rotator cuffs. She was at the support group meeting that I was facilitating, and she was not taking any time to get treatment. She hadn't really gone to see her own doctor. She knows she needs surgery, but keeps putting it off because she doesn't want to give up caring for her husband for the time that she would need to recover. And this is not uncommon. Keep own medical needs aside. So one of the practical recommendations that I give, and I did this myself, is that it's so important that you, as a caregiver, talk to your primary care physician about the fact that you're caring for another person. Let them know you're a caregiver. And actually, you know, even if you're healthy and you're seeing your doctor maybe annually for an annual physical, I'd say increase the visits. I actually went to my own physician 3 times a year once I entered the caregiving role and told him what I was doing so he could monitor, you know, what was happening, because I actually had great blood pressure prior to that. My blood pressure was going up. So it started monitoring. But there was a real environmental factor that was leading to that, my stress, you know.
Sure.
So we were able to talk, and, you know, and again, and the other thing I would say, too, if something physically is strange that is happening with you, talk to your doctor about it. It's better to find out and have it tested out and proved to be wrong, a false alarm, than to delay something that could be really a catastrophic problem for you later, because the loved one you're caring for is depending on you to be healthy or to stay as healthy as possible so you could care for them. They don't want you to get, you know, sick. So that's a great question that you asked, and it's not uncommon for that to happen. Or even after the loved one passes away that you're caring for, you know, many caregivers just within a few months after caring for a loved one, because they've sacrificed so much of themselves and not taking care of themselves, they can then become very ill or pass away themselves. So not uncommon either.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, what a great strategy, Michael. I mean, I never even thought of that. Increase your own primary care physician visits. So in your opinion, how many physicians actually, when you do that, how many of them actually get like, oh, okay, I'm glad you told me that because then I want to do this, 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 and this? Or do they, you know, because sometimes you find that as a patient, we sometimes know a little bit more than the doctor at times. They don't get certain things, especially when it comes to alternative, alternative stuff. So do you find that the doctors generally tend to know the purpose in letting them know that and they know what to do specifically?
Well, again, it depends on the patient and, you know, so and sort of your own health status and age and all of that. So, again, I think it's so important that we dialogue with our doctors about what's happening with us. You know, a lot of times we stay silent or we let, and, you know, so I think it's such a vital, important piece of information that you share whatever stress is going on with your life. You know, even for people who, if you've lost a loved one, maybe you didn't care for them, but, you know, your loved one passed away, it's so important to share where you are emotionally as well with your primary care physician. You have a dialogue. And you know what? If your primary care physician doesn't want to listen to you sharing that information, then change the doctor. Because there is somebody out there that will.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're sharing vital information about yourself. And there's much more to us than just our physical status. And all of these things are interrelated, as we know. And
terms
of your emotional and spiritual health can really impact your physical health. Engage that dialogue. You're only going to be enriched from it.
Sure. And that's something that we always work with as coaches, too, is recognizing the physical impact of our spiritual and emotional health, you know, because our clients are often experiencing those sorts of things, and that's what we help them work through. So that makes lots of sense. So tell me, Michael, what had you decide to write a book about your experiences? Because I can imagine a lot of people after going through that kind of experience are like, oh, my God, I'm done with this. Thank God it's over. But you went a different direction. You chose to write a book. Tell us why.
Sure, absolutely. Well, there are a couple reasons. After my father passed at the end of 2009, I basically had taken a year in transition. You know, my house was on the market. I moved in with my mom, and I decided to, launch my own consulting business at that point, so I could have a home-based business and take care of her and keep her out of a nursing home, because that was my goal. And so then the next several years, I actually cared for her. And I then made the wise decision to explore, you know, coaching as a career, and made the extra wise decision to invest in the program that you and I have both attended, which is an IPEP, and got my certification in 2011. But, you know, afterwards, my mom eventually, she passed Mother's Day of 2012. And one of the great things that I did after her passing, and I've used in-home hospice for both parents, is I took advantage after my mother passed of having bereavement counseling for a year. Because if you care for somebody and you use in-home hospice, one of the greatest benefits to that is the caregiver can access bereavement support for up to a year after your loved one has passed. And my bereavement counselor was great. And, you know, we had talked about the fact that I really like to write. So one of the great things she suggested I do is start journaling about my experiences. And that was the way to cope with grief. And about 4 months later, I actually wrote an essay called Parent Caregiving Without Regret. And I submitted the essay to a book project called the Gratitude Book Project, and it was accepted and it got published in the 2013 Gratitude Book Project edition. And the person who put that together actually has a program on how to go about writing a book. So I spent basically the winter, last winter, I started January of this year, I actually made it a goal for 2013 was to write a book using the Caregiving Without Regret as the, you know, as the topic. So I came up with the title, The Accidental Caregiver Survival Guide, Your Roadmap to Caregiving Without Regret, and just started writing last winter and developed a book with, you know, great practical tips and strategies. And it was therapeutic for me because it's not, and the book is not just about my story. It's much more than that because it also was a way for me to share some experiences I've had supporting other caregiving clients I've had the privilege and honor to work with, and to really showcase some of these stories with the strategies in a way that is meaningful to other caregivers. So I know that was kind of a roundabout way to get into your answer, but it was sort of building up over
sure.
the course of like 2 years, and the book was such a great vehicle for me to get my message out there. And it's a great starting point as a life coach for somebody who wants to engage me in services. They have a way to learn more about LifeVide and what my messaging is before they make a decision to hire me. So it's like an extra big business card in a sense.
Uh-huh.
So it's been really wonderful and a great vehicle. So I know it's impacting so many lives, and it's just done so many, you know, great things for me personally, just to be able to get that story out.
Right. Oh, that's great. That's really great. So tell me why the book is important for people to pay attention to.
Sure. Well, you know, there are two main reasons why caregivers tend to experience regret. And one is that because I said they're all in, you know, when you first get the call that something has happened to your loved one, you know, that they've had the medical crisis or they've had the, you know, the injury, you know, God forbid, a car accident, or, you know, I even know somebody who was caring for a husband who was in his 30s that got into a biking accident, who was very athletic and then became paralyzed from biking. Mm. And so when you get that call and you have to jump in, I often equate caregiving with like approaching a swimming pool. So when you approach a swimming pool, like the summer barbecue or whatever, you tend to dip your toe in the water to test the temperature before you jump in to make sure it's
right.
comfortable. When your loved one is in need of support, you don't have time to test the waters. You just jump in to the
sure.
pool of care. And after you jump in, no matter what the temperature is, your life is never the same. So you're all in for your loved one. And when you do that, it's very easy because you're so immersed in everything to take care of your loved one that you can lose yourself in the process. So, and this may be for weeks of a recovery, for months or years. I mean, you can think about people caring for Alzheimer's, people with Alzheimer's, dementia, or Parkinson's. And mm-hmm. if a caregiver totally is all in for their loved one and does nothing for themselves or gives up their own personal and professional goals, resentment builds up, anger
sure.
builds up, and you have a lot of regret for the life that you've lost, that you've
mm-hmm.
given up. And then because of all this resentment, the other major regret that comes out, because, again, you and your loved one are traveling hand in hand through some of the scariest experiences that we ever experience as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, when you know, they truly are a life and death situation. So when your loved one is going through a painful treatment, that needle or that injection may not be going into your arm, or you may not be getting the physical treatment, but you feel it. You
mm-hmm.
feel every cringe of your loved one. I mean, you take it all in. It's almost, you know, I don't want to say it's more painful than what your loved one is going through, but it's heartbreaking. It's wrenching. And because of all these scary experiences that are happening, you and your loved one are most honest with one another and will share nakedly how you feel. So it's very easy to snap at one another, to yell at one another, sometimes over really silly things, because,
mm-hmm.
again, you're so scared. You're in this place of fear, understandably. And when those things come out, caregivers can often experience regret for things they may have done or said during the journey of care if they didn't have a chance to sort of acknowledge the fact that they're in a scary situation and ask for forgiveness when those things happen. So I really made a plan that, you know, while I was caring for my mom, and, you know, before I came back to living with my parents, I had lived on my own for 16 years. So even though I was an only child and was doted on and spoiled probably as an only child, coming back
mm-hmm.
to live with them after 16 years was not easy. And I had my
sure.
own way of running a household. And after my dad passed, you know, I was now my mother's partner, in a sense, her, you know, her housemate again. I was not her husband. I was her son, but I was an adult son. And I had my ways of doing things, and we were very close and got along.
Mm-hmm.
She was a beautiful person. But there were times that things came out of her mouth that would get under my skin, and sometimes I snapped. I'll be honest,
mm-hmm.
I was human. And
sure.
But I made a point of not going to bed angry. So I would
mm-hmm.
always apologize. But do you know that 9 times out of 10, when I apologize, she said to me, I don't even know what you're apologizing for? And the reason
mm-hmm.
I bring that up is a lot of caregivers may hold guilt or resentment after, you know, or you know, just regret for things they said or did while their loved one was alive. That their loved
sure,
one
and it didn't, and it didn't occur that way for the loved one, right? Yeah.
And that sure. And that guilt really weighs you down. So it's so important. Be honest. Acknowledge your fear. You're going through a very scary journey. You know, it's okay to go there and acknowledge it. And that will help you pass through those storms of fear and build your energy up so you can, you know, you can again face them together
sure.
In a more calm way.
Sure. You know, what's interesting, excuse me, what's interesting, Michael, is I'm just having a flashback to before my dad was in the nursing home, and he was still at home, but we knew that he could no longer be left alone for any, even a short period of time. You know, it got to the point where, okay, a short period of time for my mom to go shopping was fine, but beyond that, you know, no. And then it got to the point where even a short shopping trip wasn't really possible. And to give her a break and some respite care, I sent her to Florida while I stayed with my dad for 5 days. And I remember yelling at him, you know. Mm-hmm. There'd be things that he would say or do that just didn't make sense. And even though at some level I knew that these things weren't his fault, it was I just experienced frustration. And sometimes I would lose it and I would yell at him. And then I would always apologize, like you said, you know, at the end of the day or just a few moments later. And he would always very sincerely respond with, "Don't worry about it. It's okay."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like he was avoiding it or just going, yeah, it's fine. I mean, I really got a sense at an energetic level that, like, it really was okay. It wasn't sticking with him. And
right.
So you're right, and that makes sense. And part of that also might have been the dementia that he might not even remember it later, you know, which is partially what might be going on there right now.
Absolutely.
That kind of
and the apology is for us. It's not for them.
Right.
You understand? It is for them, but it's about clearing that and acknowledging that, you know, we had a slip, an understandable
sure.
slip. And then the biggest part of forgiveness is to forgive yourself.
Yeah.
Because, again,
yeah.
you're in this very scary situation and you're human.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. So, you know, reports are showing that we have about, I think it's approximately 65 million caregivers in the U.S. You had said you alluded to the numbers before, and even who some of those people are. You talked about people who are caring for veterans, and then of course, you know, we talked on just within the CHORUS community how that's happening. But as we look at those 65 million caregivers in the U.S., who are they, and how do they tend to becoming caregivers? Obviously, most of them, I would imagine, are becoming caregivers accidentally, as you mentioned. But what's sort of the demographic of those that find themselves in the caregiving role?
Sure. So I've mentioned some of them already, which is, again, a loved one who gets struck by a catastrophic illness or a veteran returning from war with injury or a car accident. And then the other way is, you know, the parents that have a special needs child, who give birth to a child with special needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, again, I mentioned from my career supporting people with disabilities, I have tremendous respect and admiration for family members who are raising children with special needs. That is a lifelong commitment of care. From
yep.
the time they take their first breath to the time you, as a parent, if you outlive your child, take their last breath, you are dedicated to them. And while I had so much empathy and love supporting, you know, those families, while before I entered the role as a family caregiver, I don't think I truly understood what it meant to advocate and fully care for and support someone who was so dependent on you for everything. And so I have such a new perspective. The other thing to say, too, is of these people entering care, the demographic, because of our population, is changing. And so we have a lot of sandwich generation caregivers because people are living longer. So many people are caring for an aging parent and a special needs child, or an aging parent and a spouse who may have had a stroke and is now recovering because people, again, are living longer. So many of these caregivers are caring for more than one person. And just so you know, too, AARP released the AARP Association, you know, the American Association of Retired People released a study back in the summer of 2013 with some staggering statistics. Right now, for every older person, let's say over the age of 75, there are 7 younger people available to care for them. But because of the, you know, the baby boomers are becoming senior boomers and our population changes are happening, by 2030, which is now basically 16 years away, that ratio is going to be 3-1. It's going to go from 7-1 to 3-1. So, you know, people talk about the fear of the population changes, its impact on Social Security and Medicare going bankrupt. Well, mm-hmm. we have a lot less people that would be available to care for the older people in the future. I'm not personally so concerned about this because, as I said, many caregivers are caring for more than one person. And mm-hmm. if more organizations or spiritual organizations are do like your Nightingale Brigade, you'll be out there, you know, or groups of people like you in the future doing this to support others. So, again, there will be new unique models to come in terms of supporting caregivers, but it's important to see. The other thing, too, is caregivers traditionally have been the oldest daughter in a family. You know, when families were staying close together and they tended mm-hmm. to be larger, a natural progression of care usually fell to the oldest daughter. Well, that's not so much happening anymore. And even when families are larger, we are now finding that more and more men are stepping up to the plate. So it's not all women that are caregivers. Actually, it's 39% of caregivers are now male, so family caregivers. So
wow.
So these numbers, the dynamics are changing. The majority are still female, but there are a lot of men that are stepping up to the plate to be caregivers
mm-hmm.
and for their loved ones. So again, like I said, the numbers are changing, and that's why it's so vital for more of us to be out there supporting caregivers and educating caregivers and preparing caregivers with a plan so that families have a plan. So when tragedy or an unexpected situation happens, you have a plan in place that you could start to execute. So,
mm-hmm.
And that's one of the messages I try to communicate as well, you know, when I'm speaking to families. It's you can never pre-plan for everything, but it's so important to have some key documents in place. And we can talk about that a little bit if you like, shortly.
Sure. Great. Let me just, since we're at about the halfway mark, I just want to take a very quick break with an announcement of the upcoming shows, and then I want to come back to the challenges that caregivers are facing and continuing our discussion with Michael Bloom here, caregiver coach and author of the Accidental Caregiver Survival Guide. By the way, if we will be taking your calls, and if you do call in, the number is 646-716-9397. Be sure to press 1 on your keypad to indicate that you want to ask a question. So if you just dial in and don't press 1, we won't get to you. So if you've dialed in and you want to ask a question, be sure to press 1 on your keypad to notify us that you do, and then we'll pick up your call. So upcoming shows here on the Life Coach Radio Network. Tomorrow night at 9 p.m., Frank Talk, Survive the Holidays. So Frank Talk with David Frank Gomes is a show about the art and science of a happy, meaningful life. So Surviving the Holidays will be Frank's topic tomorrow. Then Tuesday at noon is Fun to Fortune, Entrepreneur Startup Success with Coach Jeff. So Coach Jeff Valensky leads a conversation with those who have created fun businesses and uncovered their fortune in the process. So callers and guests will share their inspiration, their businesses, and what makes their businesses fabulous, the challenges, the obstacles, and what helps them persevere and prosper. So that way you can listen and learn as you go through the startup waters. And then on Wednesday at 7:30, Purposeful Conversations. This is our usual show at that time slot, and unfortunately I could not access the details of the show online to be able to give you any details about it, but I do know it is always a wonderful show. That's Purposeful Conversations, Wednesday at 7:30, so be sure to tune into that. And then, of course, January 5th at 9 o'clock is the next episode of Mark My Words, and I'll be introducing and interviewing Coach Amina Khalil, who is also a graduate of IPEC Coaching and is one of my students, and she was going to be talking about couples and communication and relationships. Amina works with engaged couples to build a strong, heartfelt understanding and strong foundation for their marriage. Her specialties include relationship, strategic intervention, marriage education, and divorce prevention coaching. I think that'll prove to be a really, really great show. And let's see. So actually, before we get to the next question that I have for you, Michael, we actually have a caller on the line who has a question. So let's go ahead and pick that up. So caller, last 4 digits of your phone number are 0429. That's all I can see. What's your question?
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
And hi, Mark. This is Susan Lineski. I'm also an IPEC graduate and
hi,
an alumni. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Good to hear you.
Good. Michael, I think what you're doing is just fantastic, and I am the eldest daughter of the family. My mother passed in 2000 suddenly at the age of 67. My father is now 81, and I'm going to have to make some decisions pretty soon here with the family. One of the things I'd like to ask you is I need to take his keys away. Not me personally, but somebody has to tell my father that, you know, he can no longer drive safely. He has had many accidents this year. Thankfully, nobody has gotten seriously hurt. But I feel guilty because it's one of the last freedoms that he has. So how do I go about doing that, or what would your advice be to me?
Sure. Well, Susan, that's a really wonderful question, and a very common thing that caregivers go through in terms of thinking about that. And thank you so much for the question. I just want to say, and you know, kudos to you for really thinking about that as a concern. And I'm really I'm excited to have you on the call as well. So
thank you.
I heard your show recently too, which was really wonderful.
Thank you.
So it's great. It's great to talk to you live. So anyway, one of the strategies that I often share with people, and often this is, you know, because we've talked about, and first to ask a clarifying question about your father is, how cognitive is he in terms of
there are times he's very sharp, okay, but
okay.
Then there are other times, and they are becoming more frequent, that he is getting forgetful. My brother is living with him right now, but I don't count on my brother for very much of anything, and my two sisters are out of state, so
okay.
He does have a lady friend, but the problem there, Michael, is that she's 4 years older than him, and they're companions, but she is going to be going into some kind of living facility herself. So, you know, he's just really never bounced back from when Mom passed so suddenly. So the thing is that he'll drive, and he'll drive 20 miles an hour, or he'll drive 30 miles an hour, you know, and to him that's pretty fast.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
right, yeah.
Or he'll just decide to turn left, you know, when he shouldn't turn left.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, one of the things that I have found to be useful, see, an older person, when we talk to them about these issues, often feel, you know, it becomes defensive because it's really pointed to them
Absolutely.
Having a decline of capacity. And that's very frustrating because then especially if it's one of the last forms of independence, because those of us that drive, we take it for granted, you know, we've done it our whole lives, you know, so it's very difficult. So, one of the things is to try to bring these things in that it's a common issue. So, like, a little separate issue, I've got a thing with, like, a healthcare proxy. When you bring it up for a form, I often say that instead of just having your loved one complete one, is to everybody in the family that's their complete one, because something can happen to us at any age. So that way your loved one's not doing it. So with the driving, you know, so there's a few ways to handle that. One would be just to have, you know, an open discussion with him about your fears and your concern, and that you need his help to figure out how you can map out a strategy to decrease the amount of time he's on the road, at least to start off with.
Right,
still
absolutely.
Still get his needs met. So maybe it's not an all or none situation to start off with, but that's a way to bring up the conversation that you know that he wants to get out to get certain chores done or certain shopping done and all of that. So if he was to drive less, what are some ways that others could help him or support him to get his needs met when he needs to get them done? And engage him in the strategy to figure that out. Or, you know, Dad, maybe today you're able to drive, but in a couple of weeks you might not be able to. Something really could happen. So can we map out a strategy for how we could handle that? And then you could start that. The other way is to see if you can get into an appointment with his doctor.
Absolutely. That's what I was thinking about, right.
And then, because a lot of older people, especially of that generation, respond to authority and view as if their doctor is the authority figure. So if the doctor says you really shouldn't be driving anymore, and this is what I recommend to people in your age and your condition and blah, 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 that might help. And so that would be, you know, a second. The real key is, and the reason the loved one fears it, is they don't feel they're going to have their needs met or they're going to feel extra isolated. So if you can map out a strategy to not have that happen and figure out a way to involve your siblings in that, and I know that can be tough. And I hear you with the older daughter.
Yes, and this is not uncommon, too,
because there's a lot of frustration and that can happen with that. But there's a lot of ways to communicate online, to set up a little online community that's free. So you can engage in conversation and get people involved if you want. So and do that. One is lotsofhelpinghands.com. That I recommend to lots of clients. It's a free online community, lotsofhelpinghands.com. You can set up a free online community where you can start to store certain information about your loved one. It's confidential. Invite people to be part of it. You can set up a calendar. So if your dad has appointments that you need some assistance with, it doesn't have to just be your siblings. It could be other, you know, friends that you have in his area that could be part of that community and can help. So he gets out when he needs to get out. Was this helpful for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you. Also, you know, I do, I've been doing a lot of coaching parents of kids that have eating disorders. And I find that is another, that's another part of the caregivers. And it almost mirrors the elder caregiving because they are, you know, they feel guilty if they have a life and or if they take the day off to go do something. And so it kind of meshes in with what I coach too. So, you know, I'm definitely going to buy your book. And you've been very, very helpful, and you've given me a few ideas, and I was thinking along the line of talking to my father's doctor about, you know, about his driving, because I figured that if it came from him, it would be a little easier for him to take and to accept.
Yeah, that was
absolutely.
My doctor. My dad's doctor's. I'm sorry, my dad's doctor's strategy was the same thing, actually. We're able to do it with several things and have found that very to be very, very effective. I think the bottom line message there, and this is the theme throughout your book, Michael, is you don't have to do it alone. There's other people that can help to enlist their help. So, you know, just remember that. So, Susan, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you. And
by the way, listeners out there, if you want to listen to when I interviewed Susan about the eating disorders work that she does, please feel free to check out my website and you can see the archive of that show. So thank you for calling again, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
So, yeah, and I think that's really important, Michael. That's probably a point that just cannot be overstated is you don't have to do this alone. And so many caregivers probably feel like they have to do it alone. They don't want to bother other people, and that leads to burnout. And I want to talk about burnout with you in a few minutes, but we actually have another caller that I'd like to pick up with a question. So caller phone number 1679, you're on Mark My Words.
Hi, Mark. It's Gretchen.
Hi,
Michael.
Hi, Gretchen.
Thanks so much for this, and I am currently in Mark's IPEC Washington class focusing on caregivers from my own experience, and one of the things that Susan spoke to earlier really resonates with me about when you are the oldest daughter, and you sort of, by default, you are just given you assume the responsibility and it's sort of expected of you, et cetera. And I'm actually about to go to the assistance of my father who, you know, he's doing okay, but he could use some help. And I don't want to be stuck being the bossy older sister. And, you know, so here we're getting into, you know, assumptions and limiting beliefs to use some IPEC language. But I want to know how to ask for help, and if that's something that you have come across or coached around in your experience?
Great question.
Absolutely. That's an excellent question and one of my favorite questions, because this is what can lead to burnout. And first of all, kudos to you for recognizing what your role may be. And I would say one of the ways consciously to sort of shift that belief for yourself is that if you do step into the role as to being a primary caregiver, don't feel you're doing it because you have to. Find a way to do it because you want to. Each day that you will serve in that role, or any of us serve in that role, we're making a choice to serve. So no matter how much other people serve or do or don't do, we can only control what we do. So if you start from that as a starting point, that's great. The other thing is caregiving, and if you're in a primary caregiving role, can be very isolating. And sometimes people, when they're in that role, feel that they need to be Superman or Superwoman and kind of do it all themselves, and especially if they're the oldest sibling, because they're used to kind of directing or coordinating and doing all these things and kind of naturally fall into that role, they can do that. So you want help. I often say caregiving can be like being on Caregiving Isolation Island, and that's one island you want to vote yourself off of as soon as possible. Take the torch and run. But one of the primary ways to do this without siblings getting angry at one another, and I'm an only child, but I have others that I've supported that have siblings, the big mistake that you can make in trying to get help is to direct a certain activity for somebody else in your family to do. So one of the best ways to do this is make a list of all the activities caregiving role on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, and on an as-needed basis. Once you have all that information, and you'll have a whole list of tasks, you can then approach others in your family or friends with a menu of items that people can use to support. So they can self-select what they want to do based on their skill, their talent, their ability. Because the best way to get help from others is to let them choose what they want to do. And if they do something they want to do, they're likely to do something more. So then if you just give them one thing. So if you give people choice or a menu of options, you're more likely to get support. I find that to be the most effective way, because certain people don't want to do certain things, and they may not have any way to really say that. So instead of saying they don't want to do it because they don't want to do that particular activity, they say they're busy, or they don't have time, or they don't do this. And then you, as the primary caregiver, start to feel resentment and feel upset. And then when you ask for help again on a specific thing, they don't do it. And then you feel more resentment and disappointment. And then they enter what you consider, some caregivers consider, to have deadbeat family member. But a lot of times it's all in the approach. And if you can give people a whole list of things that they can see need to be done, they can step up. And there's all kinds of things that can be done, even in managing if the person's living in a house. You know, there's lots of things that can be done around the house to be supportive. And even other things that might be able to help you with in your own life outside of the caregiving role, so you can do something. And the other thing I would say, too, I don't know if you have younger children in the family. A lot of people don't think that kids and even teenagers can be helpful just from coming over and sometimes playing a game with grandpa, you know, can offer respite to a caregiver. You know, you can find a way to involve the kids. They actually feel privileged if you do. A lot of older family members don't want to burden their younger family members with this, but there could be fun ways to incorporate them into the caregiving support plan. So that could be some fun activities, could be helpful.
And you know what I really like,
yeah.
Michael?
Those are a few suggestions. Yeah.
What I really like, Michael, about what you said to Gretchen, too, is the whole thing about choice, you know, giving people choice. And for those of us who are coaches, as many of our listeners out there are, you know, we always talk about coaching our clients to give them choice. Because when we have choice removed, we feel helpless and we go to a victim level, right? So it just makes so much sense that if you give people choice, they're going to be more enrolled in wanting to help. They choose something that they want to do, and then it doesn't feel like as much of a have to. So I think that's a really great a great piece of advice. So, Gretchen, thank you so much for the call, and I will be seeing you actually out in Seattle the third week in January, right?
Looking forward, and looking forward very much. And Michael, too, I think you spoke something really important about this, and you know, that is the multi-generational involvement. So thank you. That I think is really, really important too. Thank you. Thanks.
You're welcome.
You're so welcome, Gretchen.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the call.
You bet.
So, so Michael, what are some, as we talk about choice, what are some of the signs of caregiving burnout, and what are some of the choices that caregivers can make to either avoid it in the first place or at least manage it once it comes on?
Okay, well, sure, that's a great question. So let's talk about some of the signs and symptoms, okay? And some of them are, you know, one of the number one symptoms is losing sleep, not able to sleep, having thoughts rolling in your head. You can't shut the brain off at night, so you have trouble falling asleep. Another one would be appetite changes. You know, some caregivers will stop eating, and some caregivers, like me, will put on what I call the caregiving 40. So we eat more when we're under stress. So there's the, you know, the freshman 10, I call it the caregiving 40. But appetite changes.
Which can increase. That could be in either direction, right? The appetites can increase.
It could go either direction. I wish it had gone the other way, but it didn't. I'm still trying to work off that weight that I gained during my caregiving role. But then there's some caregivers, unfortunately, will, you know, may experience some anxiety or panic during the day, have migraines, lack of interest in activities that maybe they enjoyed before the caregiving role, you know, when people ask them to participate, so they're showing lethargy, feeling like a victim day in and day out, and then even turning to increased use of prescription drugs or alcohol, so because of feeling uncomfortable or increased physical pain. So one of the things I want to say of all of these symptoms and signs, this goes back to my point, talk to your primary care physician. If any of those things are happening and you're in a caregiving role, let your doctor know you're caregiving and you're having symptom X, Y, or Z. Because there could be a physical thing really happening with you, and it's mm-hmm. always best to have that tested out and explored before we say it's emotional or stress-related.
Right.
So sure. If it is nothing physical and you're not having an illness or disease and you know it's stress-related, then you could start to work on that. And the best way to cope with stress, so your stress balloon doesn't blow up to the point that it explodes and you have a emotional breakdown from what you're doing, and then you're no good to the loved one you're supporting, is to take care of yourself. And, you know, engage regularly in activities that maybe you used to enjoy before you started caregiving. Find a way mm-hmm. to do it. You know, one of the caregivers I was working with was caring for a wife with Parkinson's, who was reaching, there seems to be a lot of Parkinson's in my life last year or so. But he had retired a couple years earlier, and one of the things he was looking forward to doing in retirement was playing golf.
Uh-huh.
And he would golf several times a week. Well, after his wife's, the Parkinson's progressed to the point that she needed really 24-hour support, he stopped golfing. And he hadn't golfed at the point I was talking to him for like 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was feeling pretty miserable. And so when we talked about this, it was kind of like he couldn't see a way to golf yet until after his wife died, mm-hmm. whenever that would be. And what a heart, you know, so it was kind of like, why are you putting this off? Well, how can I leave? And I said, you know, well, you can get somebody to come in and provide some respite support so you can go out and golf if that's something you really want to look into, if that's important to you. And, so he thought about this and processed. You know, a lot of times we think of getting support or paid support or other support for our loved one based on their need. But in mm-hmm. the caregiving role, it can be based on our need to get some time to do something we really like. But the bottom line is self-care is not selfish. So while we talked this through and maybe golfing 3 days a week was no longer realistic like he used to do in the past, could he have done mm-hmm. it, maybe do it twice a month? So again, you put something in your calendar you have to look forward to, because when you're a caregiver, your calendar is filled with all kinds of activities that are not
sure.
really enjoyable.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
So it's really key. And that's why my main mantra is put chocolate in your pill box.
I love that.
So
when I read that in your book, I was like, oh, my God, I love it. I've been telling people that all the time in many contexts.
And the chocolate's a metaphor. So
right.
The chocolate is whatever your special chocolate is, which is an activity that you really love or enjoy. You know, find a way to dose yourself regularly so you keep yourself energized to,
yeah.
you know, keep going in your role, because it's so important to do it. So whatever the things that you enjoy, find a way to schedule it and get help to get it done. And don't
Does it have to be
guilty.
A metaphor? Can you use real chocolate?
Well, I use real chocolate all the time. I'm a chocolate
holic.
There you go. But
There you go. Yeah, no, and it's so important because, you know, if your sleep is disrupted and you're having panic attacks and you might be abusing alcohol or prescription drugs, that puts the loved one that you're caring for at risk.
It does.
You know, so it's so important, not just for you, but for the person that you're burning yourself out giving care for, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's why I really wanted to do that for my mom back then, you know, give her 5 days in Florida. And she went down to her sister's, and I contacted a spa down there, and I paid for a whole spa treatment for her so she could just pamper herself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it made such an enormous difference. It made such an enormous difference for her, not to mention the incredible time that it gave me to spend with my dad in a way that I don't think I have ever spent with my dad in my life. 5 days, one-on-one, him and me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm not going to have that ever again. And so I was thankful that, you know, we kind of accomplished two things, giving my mom a break as well as giving me that incredible experience. And it was quite a painful but lovely experience in so many ways. And I got in touch firsthand with, you know, how hard it is on my mom. So chocolate in the pill box, definitely, definitely important, and taking care of yourself. So as we start approaching the top of the hour, I just want to ask you, Michael, what's your, like, the favorite story, you know, or result that you've gotten with a client or anybody that you've worked with in this capacity? You know, as coaches, we all have our success stories that we like to share with people we've worked with. So what's your favorite story?
Sure. Well, I have several, but I'm going to choose this one because I really do love it the most. I, you know, one of the things in our world, Mark, especially in the life coaching world, is we bounce into people who, you know, are greatly holistic practitioners. So I had the privilege to work with somebody who was a holistic practitioner and knew a whole lot and really had great belief in natural things you could do for your body in terms of foods you can eat, you know, fruits and vegetables and certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this woman's father had bladder cancer, and she and her one brother were kind of sharing in the caregiving role, and unfortunately the cancer moved into a terminal stage and the dad was in the hospital. But she was extremely frustrated with her dad and her brother. Leading up to this terminal stage, she would bring in healthy fruits and vegetables and good foods for her dad to eat, and he would typically ignore them, and the brother did not believe in her holistic way of living and would bring in the chocolate and the cakes and the cookies and all kinds of stuff. So they would get into arguments in front of the dad about food, you know, as to who was doing this. And, you know, the name calling would go back and forth, you know, you're killing dad with all this sugary crap and, you know, and all this stuff. And and we had a conversation about, especially when the dad started moving to a terminal stage, about what was really going on here. And again, when she was able to acknowledge that she was afraid, that she was scared, and now the cancer was terminal, this holistic way of living and all the knowledge that she accumulated was really the only way she felt she could have any impact on her dad and his well-being. And so we were able to process, and the next time she actually went in to visit, she had a great conversation with her dad and was very candid about how she was feeling and her fear and, you know, and that this was her one pathway that she felt she could be of help. And she acknowledged her dad, I'm going to continue to bring my healthy snacks in, and if you touch them, that's fine, and if you don't, I'll just take them home, and I won't say anything about it. So at the end of their conversation, he acknowledged that he loved her, and he actually dipped into her. He went into the cooler and munched on some of her healthy things, and then he went about 15 minutes later and had a chocolate chip cookie that his son had brought in. But she didn't get angry about it. So we joked about the fact that, you know, basically he had her healthy snacks with the chocolate chip cookie chaser. So nobody had another argument about food, and the dad did end up passing about a month later. But the good thing about this, and the reason I bring up this story, is when we're under stress and everybody is coming at it. Her brother came at it from the angle of, I want to give my dad comfort during his remaining days. She came at it that I want to give my dad, their dad, you know, comfort but well-being in his remaining days. They both came from the same loving place. They had a different way of going, but by being honest and opening this up, it was able to no longer have a rift, because imagine a sibling rift could go on for years after dad passed over food.
Sure.
So that's sure. where the stress of all this can really break down to. It can be very minor, but it's a bigger issue that's going on. And just acknowledge your fear and where you're coming from. And you can get through those. You can get through those things in a much more peaceful way.
Sure. Wow. And it, you know, it also shows that having a sense of humor is so important, even at times like this.
Absolutely.
You know, and being able to reframe things humorously, like a chocolate chip cookie chaser, which now I'm having a craving for after the show. So thanks for that, Michael.
Anybody who talks to me always has cravings for chocolate, and I bring chocolate to every presentation I lead. So that's
wonderful. Great. So, you know, I have one last question that I want to ask you about how people can get in touch with you. But the question I have, first of all, is what's the most important thing that you want people to take away from this discussion? What's the most important thing for them to focus on and take away from our conversation tonight?
Sure. So, well, I guess acknowledging that any of us at any time will either step into the role of caregiver or need a caregiver. And whether we're acting in the role of caregiver or we're in need of care, just really focus on whatever your needs are and communicate honestly. If you're feeling afraid, communicate that fear to the loved one you're partnering with in that caregiving journey, no matter which role you're playing. And always be open, because you, again, are dealing with some of the scariest situations ever known to us. They truly are life-death situations. So as long as you're open and seek forgiveness if you feel something slips out and it's understandably scary, it's okay. We are human. And again, so that's the number one takeaway. And also, if you are in the role of caregiver, self-care is not selfish. Take care of yourself along the way. And that's vital, because you will be better caring in a better capacity to care for your loved one if you keep yourself dosed with energy along the way and take care of yourself. And your loved one wants you to have a life as well. They don't want you to just be on this island of support just for them. It's important. We only go down this life once, so we've got to live it to the fullest, you know, and best we can. And you can do that in a way that still honors your loved one that you're caring for. So find that balance.
Great. Wonderful. Very important message and a very good message. So Michael, how can people get in touch with you if they'd like to reach you? And I understand you have a little bit of a special offer in case anybody reaches out to you and mentions the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two ways you can find me. One is the book site. So if you want to take the book for a test drive or order it, you can go to theaccidentalcaregiverssurvivalguide.com. You can actually access free preview chapters at the site, or if you just want to go ahead and purchase the book, there is a Get the Book tab, which you can get at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or the Apple Store. The other way to find me is at bloomforcoach.com, bloomforcoach.com. And there, I offer a free resource guide of my top five recommended free caregiving resources that I have found online. When you get this guide, it's basically a one-page PDF with links to free resources. I'm not a paid affiliate, so I just want to make that clear. They're free resources, 100% free. Lots of Helping Hands, which I mentioned earlier, it's one of those resources for creating an online community. It's very easy to use. And again, it's a way to get people multi-generations to help support and get communication in terms of what's needed to support a loved one. So those are the two primary ways. And then I want to say, too, that I would be willing for, because I know I have fellow peers, very inspiring life coaches on the line, and I've been very privileged to find a great niche that is my passion in my life, and I'm enjoying every moment of being a coach and coaching others and developing this great business. So I would be willing to offer the listeners that are on this call, you know, the first three that would send an email to me at michael@bloomforcoach.com. With free session in the subject line, I would be willing to, especially if you're in support and developing your coaching business, to come up with a Bloom Your Biz strategy session. I've been starting to give this to fellow coaches because I've been rocking my own business lately, and I love to help you rock yours so you can enter to 2014 being of service, because coaching is, I think, the most powerful venue that we have to help others in the world. So, and you all deserve it. So I no matter what, please be in touch. I'd love to contact anyone. I love your connection. And thank you, Mark, for having me on the show again. It's been fabulous. So.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's been fabulous at my end too, and I'm sure for my listeners. And I so appreciate your being on the show. And also, you can also find all of Michael's resources on the Mark My Words website at markmywordsradio.com, and you'll see all of Michael's contact information, including the links to both his website, the free preview pages from his book that he talked about, and the list of free resources. So you can either go directly to his website or the markmywordsradio.com website. And you'll get all of his information so that you can be in touch with him, which I recommend if you find yourself in a caregiving role and you're struggling, you certainly, certainly do. You won't be sorry. In fact, you'll be incredibly grateful for him. So, Michael, thank you again so much, so much for being here tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks again, Mark.
You're very welcome. So before we... before we wrap it up for tonight, feel free to mark your words if you'd like. If you have feedback for us that you'd like to communicate to the Life Coach Radio Network, visit us at www.blogtalkradio.com/Life Coach Radio Network. And then click the follow button and send us a message. For feedback directly to me or suggest a show topic, just go to markmywordsradio.com and click on Home and Contact and fill in the contact form. I hope you enjoyed the past hour and that you found it engaging, enlightening, and stimulating. I look forward to speaking with you all again on December 5th when I interview Amina Khalil. So thank you again for listening to Mark My Words. I'm Mark, and those are my words. Good night.